The old man stood up and shoved the man, spitting water and hollering at the same time. Within seconds, James Doyle had turned from tossing coins into the water and was there, too, along with the rest of the volleyball players, jumping between the two before their punches could connect and make the situation worse. Lance, too, had automatically moved closer to the action, his blood pumping and his synapses firing as he watched the fight being contained. The two parties, now separated, pled their respective cases to anyone who would listen. He could hear the old man grumbling to James about his right to swim in the lane reserved for that purpose, no matter what day it was. James, whose glasses had fallen off in the melee, squinted at him and nodded his understanding as he fumbled to place the glasses back on his nose. James put his arm around the old man and began guiding him away. Lance worried about the old man, whose wheezing could be heard from a distance. Bandana Man was being led out of the pool amid loud protests. Some idiot handed him another beer, and he sucked it down like a big, thirsty baby. "You didn't tell me the 4th of July was so exciting," Lance heard the voice behind him and wondered how he could have ever mistaken it. He turned to find Jency there, wide-eyed as she processed the scene. "I mean, I knew there were contests, but actual fights? That's something to see." She gave him a little smile, and he laughed. "Guess this isn't standard where you're from?" he asked. He hoped the question would prompt her to tell him more about where she'd come from. "I told you," she said, shutting down his hopes. "I'm from here, born and raised in this very neighborhood." She shifted a heavy-looking beach bag on her shoulder. "So, did you manage to save me a seat?" She looked around the pool, taking in the wall-to-wall people. "As a matter of fact, I did," he said, and pointed toward the chairs. She gave a pleasantly surprised look. "Lead the way," she said. Kaylee. Lila led me over to the tables they set up for the pie-eating contest. "I almost won this last year," she said, then pointed at her flat stomach. "I can eat a lot more than you might think." I thought of Cutter shoveling in food at our kitchen table, the way my mom always teased him about having a hollow leg. Now a machine was feeding him through his veins. I wanted to tell Lila that she should be glad that Cutter wasn't there, or she wouldn't have a chance. But my throat closed up, and I couldn't say it. "I bet you'll win today," I said instead. We were all friends ever since the accident. That part was nice. Lila gave me a thumbs up as if she were reading my thoughts. Then I realized she was referring to the contest and not Cutter. She turned to Pilar on her other side, who'd arrived minutes earlier and was still out of sorts that they'd been so late. "My mom got a call from her stupid lawyer. I mean, it's the freaking 4th of July. Why is he even working?" Pilar asked, and shook her head in response to her own question. Lila and I nodded our understanding, even though we had no idea what Pilar was talking about. But we did feel bad that she'd missed out on both the coin toss and the egg toss. Well, Lila felt bad. I was glad I'd had a partner for the egg toss, though Lila and I hadn't even come close to winning that. I heard my name being called and looked over to see Zell with her camera. Why she wanted to take a picture of me, who wasn't even a relative, was beyond me. But Zell did things I didn't understand a lot. She was a nice old lady, and I shuddered to think what would have happened to me if she hadn't given me a place to stay since the accident. I'd be spending a lot of time all alone, that's what. As we'd driven to the pool that morning, Zell had told me that today was Independence Day, and that meant we should think about being free, free from anything that makes us feel bad. Then she was quiet for the rest of the ride, and I guess we were both thinking of the things we wanted to be free of. Pilar and Lila and I squished up together with our arms around each other and big smiles on our faces so Zell could snap the picture with her phone. "Will you send that to my mom?" Pilar hollered at her. Zell waved like she would, but I doubted that, one, she even heard her, and, two, she knew how to send a photo to Pilar's mom. I still couldn't imagine why she wanted a photo of me, someone who probably wouldn't even live here this time next year. Next year I would be almost a teenager. I tried to picture a teenage me, but I couldn't. The man in charge of the contest came to stand in front of me.
"You ready?"
he asked and gave me a smile. I made myself smile back and nodded. He raised his eyebrows.
"You sure? You don't look ready. You look like you're a million miles away."
"I was just thinking," I said.
"About your brother?"
he asked. I wasn't shocked that he knew. Most people in the neighborhood had heard about Cutter, the news spreading like spilled milk across a table. And the man in charge of the contest lived right across the street from Zell to boot. I saw him sometimes when he mowed his grass, stopping to mop sweat off his forehead with a towel he kept tucked in the waistband of his shorts. Sometimes his younger brother got out of the house, and he had to chase him to get him back.
"Sort of," I answered. "He would probably win this contest if he was here." I had to force the words out around the lump in my throat.
"I'm sorry, Kaylee," he said, looking into my eyes in a way most people around here avoided doing. "That your brother's not here." He gave a sad smile. "So what do you say we make sure you win this contest for him?"
He made his voice sound weird, trying to be funny. I smiled back and shook my head. "I never win anything." He cocked his head.
"Well, I don't know about that. You look like a winner to me."
He winked and turned to address the horde of kids who'd assembled around the table, laughing and pushing an eye in the snack cakes piled on the table. Behind us, all the parents gathered to watch and take pictures and cheer their kids on. I knew better than to look for my mom. She was sitting in a hospital room, and though I wished she could be here, I understood she was where she needed to be. The lump in my throat grew, and I swallowed a few times, trying to make it go away. I caught the man's eye, and he nodded. He believed I could win this contest, and that counted more than he knew. I looked down at the lone snack cake sitting on my plate, and swallowed a few more times, willing the lump to go down enough for me to swallow around it. There was no reason I couldn't win this. I would do it for Cutter. Maybe if I won, he'd open his eyes. Maybe I could still somehow make everything okay. When the whistle blew, I dove into that cake, inhaling it without even really chewing. I could feel the barely chewed cake collecting in my esophagus. Thank you, fourth grade health class. As I inhaled snack cake after snack cake, the spongy, thick mass seemed to swell and hurt, but I welcomed the pain. Deserved it. I thought of Cutter's damaged lungs. I kept eating and swallowing, adding to the mass until it felt like I would choke to death. The world fell away, and it was just me, the plate in front of me, and the cakes as they came and went. I didn't think of Pilar and Lila also trying to win the contest. I didn't think of Zell snapping pictures of a kid who wasn't hers. I didn't think of my mother, who wouldn't be there to see if I won. I just thought of Cutter, of him getting better, and that somehow I was making that possible in this moment, eating snack cakes on the 4th of July at the same pool where he nearly died. I heard a whistle blow and felt someone tug my arm into the air. The man looked down at me, my arm aloft as I struggled to swallow what was in my mouth. "Water," I managed to gasp, and he handed me a water bottle as if he'd known I was going to ask.
"You won," he said. "I told you you would."
I didn't answer him. I was too busy gulping the water, thinking as I did how weird it was that something that nearly killed my brother could also be the thing that was saving me. Zell. Zell watched as James handed Kaylee her trophy for winning the pie-eating contest. She didn't know why they called it a pie-eating contest, as the kids weren't really eating pies. They were eating Little Debbie's snack cakes. But that's what it had been called for as long as she could remember. And who was she to call attention to it? She'd been surprised by Kaylee's fierceness, the way she tore into those little cakes one after the other, her body hunkered over the plate, her intensity visible. James gave Kaylee a hug that went on a second too long if you asked Zell. Not so much that anyone would notice it, but enough that Zell felt her guard go up. She'd known James since his family had moved in. He'd been attending college then, coming and going like young men do,
not really connected to his family or the neighborhood. But in his senior year of college, his father had suddenly dropped dead. James had quit school and come home to assume his role as man of the house, earning a living, mowing the grass, and chasing after his mentally delayed brother, Jesse, when he got loose. Living across the street from the Doyles, Zell could attest to the orderly way James kept up the house, to his comings and goings from whatever job he held, and the way he cared for both his mother, who had dementia and was little more than a shell of a woman anymore, and Jesse. She was sure it wasn't an easy life for him, and she did feel sorry for him at times. But one time she caught him outside her daughter Melanie's window, trying to look in. At first she thought her eyes were playing tricks on her, and she stood and watched for just a moment, wondering what was happening. It took her mind a second to catch up, to register that she was witnessing a peeping Tom in action. She hollered out his name, "James!" And he turned toward her voice with a look of horror and guilt on his face. "What are you doing?" She marched over to him. He began backing away, and before she could get to him, he broke out in a run. She hollered at his retreating figure, disappearing into the gathering dark. "I better not catch you around here again." She'd stood there for a moment, listening to her heart pounding as she caught her breath enough to go back inside. She watched as a light went on in the Doyle's house, signifying James's successful escape. The next day, after double-checking the locks on Melanie's window, she went outside to see if he'd left footprints, debating whether she should call the police and report him. It was in looking for the footprints that she saw a soccer ball and remembered that Jesse had been in the front yard kicking a soccer ball as far as it could go just before she found James by the window. One of her sons had remarked that it was too bad Jesse was mentally delayed because he sure could kick the hell out of a soccer ball. She'd picked up the soccer ball and carried it to the Doyle's front porch. She left it there for Jesse, but she never apologized to James for accusing him. She still wasn't sure what she'd seen. Now, watching him hug Kaylee, those same concerns returned. Kaylee skipped over to her, holding her trophy aloft. "I won, Zell!" she crowed, and Zell clapped her hands together, managing, she hoped, to look happy and not concerned. "That is just amazing, Kaylee. I mean, I've seen you chow down, but never quite like that." Kaylee grinned, her first real smile of the day. "I can't wait to show it to Cutter." She inspected her trophy. Then, quieter, she added, "I'm going to tell him I won it for him." "I think that's a great idea." Kaylee handed over the trophy, and Zell tucked it into her beach bag for safekeeping. Kaylee dug into the cooler for a water and took a long pull from it. "I'm so thirsty, I can still feel that cake stuck in my throat." She took another drink. "I saw you met Mr. Doyle," Zell said.
"You mean the guy doing the contest?" Kaylee asked. "The one who lives across the street?"
"Yes, I've known him a long time." Zell weighed her words carefully. Kaylee thought about it.
"His mom's in a wheelchair. I've seen him push her around. What's wrong with his brother?"
"Well, now, I don't rightly know. The family has just had its share of hardships."
Kaylee looked thoughtful again. "Kinda like mine," she said.
It was not the direction Zell had wanted this to go. She didn't want Kaylee identifying with James, sympathizing with him.
"I guess you could say that," she said. "But he's a lot older than you. He's an adult, and he's got adult problems," she added.
Kaylee gave her a duh look.
"I know," she said. "Well, I just saw him talking to you, and I wanted to make sure you knew that he is not really someone I'd want you to..."
She had run out of words. Kaylee raised her eyebrows.
"Yes?"
Zell waved her hand in the air.
"I'm just being silly, worrying like old ladies do."
Pilar called to Kaylee, and she hopped up from the chair. "I'm going to go swim," she said, already forgetting Zell's warning.
"Sure thing,"
Zell said, relieved that the conversation was over. But before Kaylee could walk away, she called out to her, Just don't ever go in his house, okay?
Kaylee gave her a quizzical look. Like I ever would, she said, then shook her head and scampered away.
Everett. The fireworks terrified Christopher. He shrieked so loudly that Bright scooped him up and ran out of the pool area, stumbling over chairs and mumbling, "Excuse me," multiple times as she hastily made her exit. Everett watched his wife and child leave. The darkened pool area was packed, making it hard for Bright to move with ease, much less while clutching a screaming child. Every few minutes, the lights of the fireworks illuminated a path, while simultaneously setting Christopher off again, his shrieks ringing out over the tinny, patriotic music playing through the speakers. Everett, embarrassed by the spectacle, wondered what he should do. Did he wait for her to settle their son down and return? Did he go after her and create another disturbance? He surveyed the various items he would have to collect in order to leave. There was no way he could accomplish that in the dark. They'd spent the whole afternoon at the pool and had participated in the potluck dinner there that evening. All around him were dishes and clothing and towels and several bags strewn about the area where they'd set up camp. He turned his attention back to the fireworks, reasoning that he'd just wait until the show ended, gather up their things, and leave. It had to be close to over, though down by the lake he could see James and his buddies still lighting fuses and scurrying around. Everett wondered idly just how much money the man had invested in fireworks, only to see it all go up in smoke. Literally. He smiled at his own joke. He felt someone's eyes on him and turned to see Jency looking at him. She smiled back, and he wondered guiltily whether she thought the smile was for or about her. Jency turned her attention back to the fireworks, but he didn't. In the dark, he could make out her blonde hair and the two blonde heads on either side of her, leaning into her. He wouldn't have pictured Jency as the consummate mother, and yet it suited her. He thought, with a pang, of Bright's resistance to having more children, of her recent announcement that she might just look for a job instead. He never thought it had to be one or the other, and didn't understand why she was making it sound like it had to be. But whenever he tried to bring it up for discussion, she closed up like a book slamming shut. Jency was sitting with Lance, the hero. Everyone had been making such a fuss over him all day, slapping him on the back and thanking him. Come on, Everett thought more than once. The guy just did what any man would do who saw a child drowning. It seemed as if Jency had fallen under his hero spell as well. Everett would be lying if he said it didn't bother him, seeing her at the pool where they used to watch the fireworks, their fingers laced together and her leaning against him the way her daughters were leaning against her now. Get a room, you two, Bright would tease. And later, after everyone had gone home, they would get a room of sorts, only it wasn't a room at all. He hadn't gone to their spot in years, felt guilty visiting that place now that he and Bright were married. It would hurt her too much to know he did that. And yet, sometimes he could feel it calling to him, the tree branches waving in the breeze, beckoning him to come and remember. He shook his head and forced himself to look back at the fireworks, concentrating on the light arcing across the sky, feeling the explosions in his heart. Lee Greenwood sang, "Proud to be an American," and on the other side of him he could hear John Boyette's mother singing along off-key, but loudly. In his pocket, he felt his phone buzz. He looked at it, a text from Bright. "Took him home. Will you just bring everything when it's over? I'm putting him to bed." He texted back, "Will do. Sorry you missed the rest of the show. Fireworks of our own later?" And pocketed his phone. He would never admit what had put him in the mood. After they'd started dating, Bright had confessed to him that each time she saw him and Jency together during high school, her heart had broken a little more. He'd been so slow on the draw, unaware of Bright's unrequited love for him, until Jency was out of the picture and Bright finally, after too much to drink one night, blurted it all out. Until that moment, he'd always thought of Bright as his best friend, his confidant. And actually, 7 years of marriage later, she still was. "Today I marry my best friend," their wedding invitations had said. And it was true. The screech of chairs being slid back into place startled him out of his thoughts. He looked around as the floodlights around the pool came back on, and people began the leaving process. He stood, stiff and sore, and stretched before gathering their things. It would take several trips to the car to get it all loaded. Someone poked him in the side, and he turned to find Jency there, looking concerned. "Is Christopher okay?"
"Yeah, he just got scared," he shrugged.
"Funny, because last year he loved them." She nodded.
"That's the age. One year they love Santa, the next they scream bloody murder if you get within 10 feet of him."
She rolled her eyes playfully. "Kids." He pointed at Jency's girls.
"They're beautiful."
She glanced over at her daughters and smiled proudly.
"Thanks." "I guess it's not really how I pictured you when I pictured you as an adult," he said.
She squinted at him while nudging her daughters in the direction of Lance's kids.
"What do you mean?"
Now he'd put his foot in his mouth.
"I mean, you just always talked about this super successful life, and I guess I thought you meant this high-powered career, you know, Sex in the City kind of stuff."
She laughed and shook her head. "I probably thought that too, but then I met my husband and, well, he wanted the life we built and I didn't stop to question it." She paused. "I didn't question a lot of things."
The last bit seemed more to herself than him. "And where is he now?"
he asked, giving voice to something he and Bright had discussed after Jency left the night she came for dinner. Jency still wore a wedding ring, so they didn't think she was divorced, and yet she was there alone and didn't seem to be going anywhere. Bright had told him she'd even asked about the schools. Maybe it was due to the beers he'd seen her sip throughout the fireworks display. Maybe it was because, he hoped, she trusted Everett. Maybe it was the fact that none of the neighborhood busybodies were around. Whatever the reason, Jency didn't hesitate to answer his question.
"Jail,"
she said, the word almost flippant, but he detected a catch in her voice. "Federal prison, to be exact," she raised her eyebrows, "for the next 10 years at least." His eyes widened at the news.
What'd he do?
He thought of the big bad things, murder, rape, bank robbery.
Wire fraud, mail fraud, money laundering, and bribing city officials.
She ticked off her husband's offenses as if it were no big deal, but her eyes gave her away.
"Turns out he was not the prince I thought he was."
He pointed at her ring.
"But you're still married?"
She twisted the ring around self-consciously, lowering her eyes. "Not officially divorced. Not yet. And until I am, I've sort of kept it on for the girls. And I guess for me. Old habits and all that." She glanced back up at him. "Had to get used to the idea."
"And are you used to it?"
She shook her head. "Not really.
Still not sure what I'm going to do next. I have to reinvent my life, make a new life for the girls. I came back here because I..."
She looked around at the pool, and he wondered if she too had memories. She took a deep breath and turned back to him.
"I would have told you I came back here because I had nowhere else to go, but I don't necessarily think that anymore."
"What do you think now?" he coaxed.
"I think I needed to come home."
He nodded, swallowed, thinking of why and how she'd left, how he'd failed to protect her. He could still see one of those damn hearts, this one under his windshield wiper, fluttering in the breeze. The crowd had thinned out. Jency's girls were chasing Lance's kids around the pool, and no one was stopping them. He could see Lance waiting for her, off to the side, shuffling his feet as he tried to be polite. Everett still had to gather their things, make the multiple trips to the car, go home to his wife and son.
"I'm glad you did," he said.
She reached out, grabbed his hand and squeezed it lightly before letting go.
"Me too," she said.
She gave him a little wave and was gone. To his credit, he did not watch her go. Jency. She watched Everett leave. He gave her a weak smile as he passed by, then trudged out of the pool and toward the parking lot. Lance cleared his throat, and she turned to face him.
"Is there a story there?"
he asked, pointing at Everett's retreating back. She raised her eyebrows.
"You could say that."
She worked to make her voice playful and light. This was flirting, as best she could recall. He shook his head.
"Something tells me you're a woman of many stories."
She nodded and gave him a sage look.
"You could say that, too."
He glanced down at her wedding ring, but said nothing. She had to take it off, and soon. She'd told herself that the moment the final papers came from her attorney, that would be her signal that it was time. It was really and truly over. "I better get them to bed," she said, indicating the girls who'd left the pool area and were swinging in the adjoining playground with Lance's kids. She heard their giggles ringing out in the night air. Other than the lifeguards and a few teenagers, they were the only people left. Lance ran his hands through his hair, and when he did, she took in the muscles flexing in his arms, the obvious strength there. She found herself wanting to feel those arms around her, and wondered if that was just a normal reaction for someone who hadn't had physical contact with a man in months, or if she was actually attracted to this one.
"Yeah," he agreed. "I should do the same with mine."
He reached for the bag that was sitting on the chair near them and hoisted it onto his shoulders.
"Thanks for hanging out today. It was fun."
She nodded. It had been fun. They talked and laughed and teased each other. He couldn't believe she'd never seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and tried to express the many apparently hilarious one-liners from the movie. But hearing him attempt a British accent was what really made her laugh. They'd socialized with the neighbors, met some new folks, eaten potluck with her parents. He'd talked for a long while with her dad. Her mother, to her credit, had not asked any questions, though Jency suspected she was dying to. The kids had played together most of the day, sinking into the chairs beside them as the fireworks began. They'd made a little unit, him with his kids and her with hers, yet all together, looking up at the night sky, their chins tilted at the same angle. She'd watched the colors explode and expand across the blackness, unable to keep herself from recalling the last time she'd seen fireworks. Last 4th of July she'd been with Arch and had no idea of what was coming. They'd gone out of town without the girls, leaving them behind with a college-age sitter she used from time to time. She and Arch and their friends had eaten gourmet small plates and drunk champagne on a yacht anchored in the Charles River as fireworks exploded over Boston. They'd gone to hear the Boston Pops and taken a historical tour of the city where much of America began. It had been a quintessential 4th celebration, and Arch had delighted in showing her all that money could buy. She had, as he'd so kindly pointed out to her from behind bars, reveled in it all. Gushing to her girlfriends about the experience after it was over had been almost as much fun as doing it. She and her friends had each tried to outdo one another with how they'd spent the holiday in a never-ending game of one-upmanship that, in hindsight, kept her breathless and anxious a lot of the time. But she'd been too immersed in the game to even know she was playing it. It was only sitting there, relaxed and at ease, flanked by her girls, wearing an old T-shirt with great popsicle drip down the front, that she could see her former life for what it was. Exhausting. Soul-sucking. As empty as her former home now was. She hadn't really missed any of the women she'd once called friends, hadn't heard from even one of them after Arch was exposed and arrested. They avoided her as though she'd caught a plague. She supposed she had. The plague of poverty. And yet sitting there by the pool with normal people, observing a normal 4th of July, she didn't feel poor at all. She felt fairly rich.
"So," Lance said as they walked together to their cars, the kids lagging behind, complaining that they had to leave. "Think you might want to come over sometime and watch the Holy Grail?" Continuing to kid around about being named Lancelot, he'd joked that the knights in that movie were more like the kind of knights he would be. Jency let him joke,
but she sensed that his self-deprecating humor was an attempt to deflect all the compliments and kudos he'd been receiving from neighbors who'd heard about him saving Cutter. She felt proud to be beside him, but not proud like she used to be beside Arch. She was proud of who Lance was, not what he had. Now he raised his eyebrows at her. She tried to process just what he was asking with his invitation. Sure, they'd flirted and spent the day together. Now he wanted to see her again. But was this a date? Or was he just being neighborly? I mean, you really shouldn't go much longer without seeing it. He kept his voice nonchalant, which didn't exactly help her figure things out. He pressed the latch on his trunk and stowed the bulging bag of pool paraphernalia, then slammed the life gate shut and turned back to her. She nodded. I'm not sure how I survived this long without it. Well then, we need to get it scheduled as soon as possible, he said. She knew he hadn't dated since his wife's departure. She'd come upon that information courtesy of Zell, who seemed to be matchmaking. Jency had laughed Zell's insinuation off, assuring Zell that the last thing Jency needed was a relationship. What she needed was a plan for getting on with life. But in the meantime, she told herself for the 100th time, he was good company, another grown-up to pass the time with. Okay, so when would be good for you? She asked. Well, today's Wednesday. It is Wednesday, right? I never know what day it is since summer started. So, maybe Friday? Bring the girls and we'll put them in front of a movie in our playroom while we watch our movie? Order some pizzas? He was doing a good job of looking spur of the moment about it, but she had a suspicion he'd worked out the details of this invitation before extending it. She pretended to think about her plans, though of course she had none, unless she counted her nightly jaunts to the hideaway in the woods, a habit she should probably break. Sounds great, she said. What time? 6:30. We'll be there, she said, and thanks for saving me a seat today. He smiled. No problem. He held out his arms for a hug and raised his eyebrows in question. It was only a hug. What harm was there in it? She walked into the same strong arms that had pulled that boy from the bottom of the pool, letting them encircle her for a brief moment, pulling her into an embrace she hadn't known she needed until she stepped inside it. Right. Christopher's meltdown over the fireworks was a blessing in disguise, in spite of the embarrassment. There'd been a message waiting for Bright on her cell when she got home. If Everett had been with her, he might have asked her who'd called or, worse yet, flayed the message himself, not out of suspicion, but just curiosity. A strange out-of-town number might raise questions, and she wasn't ready to answer them. She listened to his voicemail twice, which was a purely professional response to her own. Yes, of course he remembered her. Yes, he would still like to talk to her. Yes, he had some thoughts about her options. She could call whenever she wanted, and he hoped she had a nice 4th of July. Had she had a nice 4th? She thought back over the day, culminating in her flight from the pool with the screaming boy in her arms as people watched her instead of the fireworks. The day, she concluded, hadn't been bad or good. It had been a day like any other, another bead in a very long string. Working would add a variety to her days, challenge her, broaden her outlook past her own front yard. She'd been good at what she did. She'd had friends to chat with, respect from coworkers. She just had to ignore the pang she felt when she thought about being away from her son all day. She opted to put Christopher to bed without a bath, dodging feelings of guilt as she did. He'd been in the water that day. He was clean enough. The meltdown had exhausted him, and he needed to get to bed lest anything else set him off. She moved slowly and gently, keeping the lights and her voice low as she soothed and eased him. He was high-strung at times, unfamiliar to her, unfamiliar to Everett as well. But still she had learned how to approach him, how to be his mother. She was good at it, mostly. She managed to get him into bed without a story. He was so tired he didn't even ask for it. She smoothed the covers over him and hummed the same lullaby she'd sung to him since that first night in the hospital when she'd been left alone with him. The lullaby worked then and now. He closed those eyes of his and blissfully drifted off to sleep as she sang, surrendering the fight for another day. Wright was relieved every time this happened. She went into the kitchen and poured herself a glass of wine. She took the baby monitor with her and went to sit on their back deck. At this time of year, the trees were full of leaves and blocked her view of the neighbors behind them. In the winter, she could see right into their kitchen. She sipped her wine and listened thoughtfully to the night noises around her, cicadas and frogs and other summer creatures all singing to one another, making their own kind of music, a nature symphony. She finished one glass, then poured another, noticing as she did that the fireworks should have been long over by now. She wondered what was keeping Everett. Her heart quickened at the thought of Jency being at the pool. Jency was back, and Everett wanted another child, and she was thinking about going back to work and had called Trent Miller about it. She'd actually done it, and he'd returned her call on a holiday, no less. And now she was sitting outside, drinking alone on the 4th of July, wondering where her husband was. Her stomach rumbled, but she didn't know whether it was from nerves or from Jency's mom's potato salad that she was sure now had sat out in the heat a bit too long. She thought of the food she'd piled on her plate, barbecue and watermelon and potato salad, and regretted it. She'd passed her parents' house on the way home from the pool. A light was burning in her old bedroom window, despite the late hour. She'd wondered what crafting project her mother was into. After she and Everett had bought their own house in the neighborhood, her mother had decided to turn her old bedroom into a craft room and called her over to get anything out of it she might want to keep. She'd been hugely pregnant then, but had dutifully waddled over, sinking awkwardly onto the floor, wondering as she did if she would ever get back up again. The baby had been due in mere weeks, and the activity had been a good diversion from the rabid thoughts chomping away inside her brain as his birth neared. Alone in her old closet, she'd pulled out the boxes of birthday cards and letters exchanged between her and Jency, paged through the yearbooks on the shelf, rereading what her husband had written to her on the page she'd reserved just for him. She'd laughed at how banal his note to her was, reflecting over just how smitten she'd been and how utterly oblivious he'd been. She'd put the yearbooks back and pulled out a single spiral-bound notebook resting on the shelf beside the yearbooks, there in plain sight, just waiting to be discovered. She'd looked at the cover and hoped to God her mother had never seen it. There, written in bold black Sharpie, were the words, "Everett Michael Lewis," and nothing else. "So hokey," she'd said aloud, then turned the cover. It was a notebook she'd started and kept with an embarrassing devotion, all about Everett. She had written down any information she gleaned about him, his favorite teams and hobbies, the names of his childhood pets, and his favorite flavor of ice cream. She'd written down the sizes he wore and what clothing he liked to wear and on what days. She'd written down his daily schedule and what his dreams and aspirations were. None of those dreams or aspirations included her. She'd been both surprised and horrified to find this document, this proof of just how much she'd pined after him and for how long it had gone on. It was clear she would have done anything to have Everett and keep him once she had him. Embarrassed, she had quickly shoved the notebook into a trash bag and fled the room. Downstairs, she'd found her mother in the kitchen, frowning over a basket of tangled yarn. "Did you find anything you wanted to keep?" her mother had asked, her attention still on the yarn. She'd shaken her head and smiled, the taste of vomit still lingering in her mouth. "It's just old stuff," she'd said. "So you want me to toss it all?" her mom had asked, looking up from the basket with surprise registering on her face. "You know what they say," Bright had quipped and rubbed her belly. "Out with the old, in with the new." She hadn't believed herself then, and she didn't believe it now, especially not this summer. She was about to stand up and get her phone to call Everett when she saw a headlight swing into their driveway. She exhaled breath she hadn't realized she was holding and felt her stomach settle. She took another sip of wine and waited for Everett to find her instead of calling out to him. She waited in the dark as he entered the house and searched for her, feeling like a child playing hide-and-seek. He finally did, rushing onto the deck, panicked.
"What are you doing?" he asked, a note of accusation in his voice. "You scared me."
She wanted to tell him that he'd scared her, too, that she'd imagined Jency sending her girls home with her mother so that she and Everett could go find their old hiding place in the woods by the lake. But she couldn't say those words out loud, even if she could picture it fully in her head. Jency's late-night whispered confessions when they were girls, coming to mind unbidden. She knew it all, how Everett and Jency had dragged a blown-up mattress out to the woods, how they would lay there and stare up at the stars at night, talking and dreaming. Bright didn't think that mattress could possibly still be there after all these years. She resolved to venture into those woods again, just to see.
"I just felt like sitting outside," she said.
He looked around.
"It's a nice night, cooling off some now that the sun's gone down."
He gestured to the wine.
"Should I pour a glass and join you?"
She smiled at him, feeling relief flood her body. Surely he wouldn't do that if anything had happened with Jency. She willed herself not to ask and ruin the moment.
"Sure," she said. "That would be nice."
He disappeared inside again, and she looked up at the stars as she waited for him. He returned quickly and sat across from her at their little table. They were quiet for a moment as they both sipped their wine. She could feel the second glass beginning to blur the edges of her mind, doing exactly what she'd hoped it would.
"Sorry you missed out at the end of the fireworks," he said.
She thought again of the voicemail message.
"It was okay. It was way past his bedtime. He crashed as soon as we got home."
"I wonder how much James spent on those fireworks," Everett said. He was making small talk, and she was grateful for it. "They went on forever."
She nodded.
"They must have. I was surprised by how long it took you to get home."
She had no right to challenge him, considering, but she also wanted to know. Her words hung in the air between them, and she saw him shift in his seat, then take a sip of wine. Her heart pounded, and she, too, took a sip of wine. Only hers was more like a gulp.
"Well, I talked to some folks as I was gathering up our stuff and loading the car. You know, being a good neighbor, channeling my wife."
He gave a little laugh and nudged her.
"Did you talk to Jency?" she asked.
She tried to keep her tone light, saying the name as if she was naming any other resident of Sycamore Glen. But she could tell her voice betrayed her by the barely perceptible wince on his part. This was ridiculous. They were married. They had a child. They had a good relationship, were good friends at their core. Her inexplicable unease about Jency was either women's intuition or complete paranoia, or residual from their past, creeping in, never fully vanquished, no matter how much they all moved on. He put his glass down.
"Do we need to talk about her?" he asked, turning to face her.
She shook her head, a reflex. That was the wrong answer. They probably did need to talk about her, but she wasn't ready to, and probably never would be. They'd spent their courtship and married life successfully avoiding the topic of Jency.
"Are you sure?" he pressed. "Because I did talk to her. If that bothers you, then we need to talk about why."
She forced her mouth to smile.
"Did she say she's in love with you and can't live without you?"
She hoped she sounded like she was teasing. "Because if that's the case, then, yeah, maybe we need to talk about Jency." His laughter in response was as forced as her cavalier tone.
"No."
He reached over and laid his hand on top of hers, the weight and size of it so familiar.
"She did tell me why she came back, though."
Bright felt her heart pick up speed. She hadn't felt comfortable enough to ask Jency something that personal, yet Jency had told Everett. She didn't know if she was threatened by that degree of honesty between them,
or jealous that Jency had chosen Everett to confide in instead of her.
"Oh?" she tried her voice. "And?"
She moved her hand from underneath his and reached for her wine glass. Her wine was almost gone. She couldn't remember the last time she'd had 3 glasses in one evening, but this might be the night to do it.
He raised his eyebrows.
"It's pretty bad. Her husband's in jail. They're getting divorced. She was basically left with nothing and had no choice but to come back here and live with her parents."
"But she wears a wedding ring,"
Bright argued, as if it would change anything. Jency wasn't just here for a summer visit, Bright had come to realize. She was staying.
"She said she needs to take it off, but, well, you can understand how final that has to feel."
With the thumb of her left hand, she felt for her own wedding ring, remembering both the night Everett had put the engagement ring on her finger at their favorite restaurant in town, and the day he'd put on the band to match it, completing the set. It had been such a happy day, made even happier by the knowledge that Jency wouldn't be there. Jency's mother had relayed the news as if it was a disappointment, when it was anything but. Though she'd felt obligated to invite her former best friend, her presence on their wedding day was the last thing Bright had wanted. Bright had believed then that they would probably never see Jency again, and that had been okay with her.
"Yeah."
Her voice cracked and she cleared her throat.
"Yeah," she tried again. "I'm sure it is."
She stood up and grabbed her wine glass, her head spinning a little.
"I think I'll go get another glass. You want some?"
She started to walk away without waiting for him to respond, but he stood up and stopped her, blocking her entry to the house.
"Don't let it freak you out, Bright. Jency being here changes nothing."
He looked down at her and gave her a reassuring smile. He put his hands in her hair, leaned in, and kissed her. She tried to go with it, to focus on him there, with her. Everything was okay. There was no reason to panic. "Nothing changes," as he said. She kissed him back, trying to think about how much her adolescent self had craved this very thing. She had everything she ever wanted. They had everything they wanted. She longed to melt into him, to lose herself in him just as she had always done. Except Jency was back. She let him take the wine glass from her hand and put it on the table, leading her inside. He led her right past her phone where she'd left it. She followed her husband upstairs to the room and bed they shared, knowing as she did that the next day she would return the call. She would blame Jency for it, because it was easier than blaming herself.
Zell.
It was Kaylee's fault Zell was outside in this heat. The brim of her sun hat fell into her eyes once again, and she impatiently pushed it out of the way, feeling a smear of mud left behind on her forehead where her gloved hands had touched. With her gardening clothes and floppy, wide-brimmed straw hat, she knew she looked every bit like Shirley MacLaine's character in Steel Magnolias. But it was for a good cause. She straightened up and felt her knee respond. Kaylee kept suggesting she see a doctor, not understanding Zell's hesitance to do so. It wasn't something she could explain. Kaylee crouched down beside her with an intent expression, studying their efforts, trying her best to learn all there was to know about gardening in the short amount of time they had together. The kid was a sponge. Zell tried not to think of that eyesore house she lived in, with a desert of a front and backyard. There were no trees, and no shade, shrubs, or plants. It would be cruel and unusual to send the child back to that hellhole, and yet she had to sooner or later. She didn't like to think about that, didn't want to face what would surely end.
"That kid has an expiration date stamped right on her forehead," John kept warning her. "Don't get all wrapped up in her and forget that."
Though he was right, it didn't make it any easier to think about saying goodbye. Kaylee had given her someone to dote on, someone to nurture, just as surely as she nurtured the plants and flowers in her yard. Kaylee wasn't taking her own children's place, but she was a nice balm for Zell's hurting heart, and, Zell liked to think. It worked both ways. What would Kaylee have done this summer if Zell hadn't offered her a place to stay? Spent a lot of time at home, alone, watching the boob tube, and not learned nearly as much about the great outdoors. That's what.
Zell, are you listening to me?
Kaylee asked loudly, and Zell turned her gaze to meet those blue-gray eyes that commanded her attention.
I was asking you what you meant when you said that a garden is like a neighborhood?
She smiled and went into teacher mode. She'd taught Sunday school for years, substituted at her kids' schools. She had it in her.
Okay, so we're all pretty much living in our own houses, right? Doing our own thing?
Kaylee nodded.
But sometimes we need people around us, she almost said, like you needed me, but decided it was best not to say that. Like sometimes Mr. Lance needs me to watch Lila and Alex so we can get some work done, and I help him out.
Kaylee nodded again.
Well, plants can help one another out, and a good gardener knows which plants make the best neighbors, and which ones don't.
Like neighbors who deal drugs or steal cars? Kaylee asked. Sometimes Zell had to work hard not to let the shock show on her face when the child revealed the parts of the world she'd been exposed to. Zell tried to steer the conversation back to a more positive light.
Well, like some plants take more than their share of water or sun, or they grow too fast and hurt the roots of other plants. Some give off toxins that can kill other plants.
They're the bad guys, Kaylee said.
Yes, some plants are bad guys. But some are good guys. They add nutrients to the soil or attract insects that are good or repel insects that are bad. So when I'm planting my garden, I look for plants that work together well, that are good for one another, that help one another out.
Kaylee pointed at the garden.
So that's why you put beans near corn. Right. The beans add nutrients to the soil so the corn can grow better, and the corn provides a stalk for the beans to climb.
She looked around the garden.
And the marigolds are near the beans because they keep the beetles away, she added, recalling information Zell had shared days ago.
Zell held up her hand for a high five, something she'd learned from her kids.
You got it.
Plus, Kaylee continued, marigolds are just pretty, I think.
Zell nodded. I do, too.
Kaylee wandered away, and Zell tugged at a few more weeds she'd spotted during their impromptu gardening lesson. Satisfied for the day, she pulled off her mud-caked gloves and called over to Kaylee, who was over on the deck studying a piece of paper they'd printed off the computer. The paper detailed the steps needed to have your yard declared a wildlife habitat.
Okay, where's that hummingbird feeder we bought? We could hang it right over here.
I think we need to build a pond,
Kaylee hollered back, looking up from her paper.
Says here that ponds are good for frogs and also provide water for animals and insects. Do you think Mr. John would dig us a hole?
Zell frowned at the girl, feeling another trickle of sweat snake its way down her chest and into her bra, which was already soaking wet. She didn't say what she was thinking, which was that standing water also attracts mosquitoes.
I think we need to complete step one before we move to step four, Zell responded. You're getting ahead of yourself again. What's our motto?
She huffed her way across the yard to get closer to Kaylee. Kaylee rolled her eyes, already approximating a teenager just a little too closely.
One step at a time, she moaned.
Zell smiled.
Well now, Taskmaster, do I have your permission to go inside and fix us some lemonade?
Kaylee grinned and nodded.
That sounds good.
Okay, you want to come in too? Get out of this heat? The July sun was particularly brutal, a blinding white orb relentlessly shining above their heads. Truth was, summer wasn't the best time to undertake such a project. Spring or fall would have been much better. Zell had tried to convince Kaylee that they didn't have to make the wildlife habitat in a rush, but she could tell the girl knew she didn't have long before she went home and didn't want her efforts to be lost again. In her frequent check-in calls and stop-in visits, Kaylee's mother had offered for her to come back home, but Zell had always replied, "Well, she's no trouble at all. You just let her stay, and it'll be one less thing for you to worry about." John thought the whole habitat idea was plumb crazy, and he told her so in private, but she just told him to mind his own business. "I don't tell you that chasing a little white ball all over God's creation is crazy," she'd scolded. He'd given her that look that told her there was more he wanted to say, but 35 years of marriage had taught him it was best not to. He'd kissed her instead and strolled out of the house, his golf shoes clacking across the hardwoods. She'd told him 100 times not to put those damn things on in the house. Zell mixed the sugar and water to heat on the stove, then got out the juicer to juice some lemons. Kaylee had never seen lemonade made this way. She'd only had the powdered kind, and now she begged her to make it. The girl had put on some weight since she'd gotten to her house. Zell supposed that was a good thing, even if that simple syrup was wreaking havoc on her own waistline. But she couldn't resist at least a small glass if she went to the effort of making the stuff. She'd been cooking up a storm for Kaylee in the weeks she'd been there, reveling in the girl's delight at what she prepared. It was nice to cook for someone who appreciated it. She fished her cell phone out of her purse just to check and make sure none of the kids had called or John hadn't had a heart attack on the golf course, a real fear she'd had ever since that very thing happened to Lars Peterson several years back. She saw that she had indeed missed a call, but it was from Lisa. She peeked outside to make sure Kaylee wasn't coming inside, Zell's heart thrumming in her chest as it did any time Lisa called. Zell always feared bad news about Cutter. How in the world would she break that kind of news to this child she'd grown so fond of? Kaylee had ventured into the front yard and, from the looks of things, was trying to find a good spot for the pond that John would probably never consent to, though Kaylee had charmed him, no matter how much he said otherwise. Her heart in her throat, Zell clicked on the number and listened as it began ringing. Lisa answered on the third ring, her voice husky and gravelly, typical of smokers, though Kaylee said her mother had quit. She guessed that she'd probably gone back to it, due to the stress. "Lisa?" she asked. "It's Zell Boyette." She almost explained who she was, but stopped herself. "Oh, Zell, I tried calling you earlier," Lisa chirped, her voice rising higher than Zell had heard it before. She got the feeling there was good news. "I saw that. Kaylee and I were outside working on that wildlife habitat she was telling you about. Boy, when that girl gets a bee in her bonnet..." "Cutter's awake," Lisa interrupted. "He's awake! He got a long road ahead of him, but they expect him to make a full recovery."
"Well, that's just..."
"Just wonderful," Zell replied. "Can you bring Kaylee up here? Today?" Lisa asked. Zell didn't know her heart could lift and fall at the same time. This was the best possible news, and yet Kaylee would be leaving. Even as she was gushing to Lisa about how happy she was that Cutter was going to be okay, she was thinking about finishing that habitat. She'd just make sure she could have Kaylee over to visit, as much as it took until school started back. She would make sure the girl got to see the sign declaring it an official habitat, planted proudly in the yard. "I can definitely do that. She'll be thrilled. Cutter's been asking for her. He doesn't remember anything from that day, so please just warn her we'd like to avoid talking about it. Don't want him getting upset." "She just wants to see him. She's been so worried." Zell took a deep breath. "I think she feels guilty, at fault somehow." "Well, I'll talk to her. Reassure her," Lisa said. "That would be nice," Zell said. She'd got the room number they'd moved to since Cutter was out of intensive care and promised to head to the hospital just as soon as possible. She ended the call. Before she went anywhere, she was going to take a shower. "Kaylee," she called. She bustled outside, rounding the corner of her house to the front yard where she'd last seen Kaylee. But Kaylee wasn't there. She scanned the yard, but it was empty. She moved to the backyard, calling out for Kaylee. But the backyard was empty, too. The squirrel feeder they'd planned to mount later still sitting on the patio. She ran back to the front yard, yelling Kaylee's name loud.